Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am your host for this coming hour, Ursula Rudenberg, and I think there's going to be a whole host of different hosts stopping in throughout the hour. Susan Franson will also be here, and KHOI's intern, Trey Moore, will be presenting another installment of his series called Aims Untold. And, of course, Aladdin Al-Kathiri is the air traffic controller today. And I think also CeCe Iverson, a KHOI reporter, will be joining us as well. And so welcome and stay with us for the next hour. I have eagerly been looking for signs of spring, as you are doing so too, I'm sure. And in doing that, I've been tuning into our neighbors, the wild ones among us. I was sitting on the front step in our front yard this week, and being close to ground to the ground that way, I observed among the brownness little flowers, snowdrops. And they're like a last farewell tribute to the great snow cover that that just left. I felt gratitude for that. I feel gratitude for the fleeting little flowers. And then a robin came hopping along, pecking between the brown leaves, and it kind of hopped a little bit close to me, and it stopped and fixed me with a quick stare and gave a little bird shout in my direction, as if to say, of course it's spring. Got worms to eat. And I've been making an effort to notice our neighbors, the birds that are nesting in our yard, because there's a lot of them, and they all seem pretty animated by now. And then a battalion of Canada geese flew high above, calling, and of course I also heard them against the inevitable roar of a train. So March 20th was the official first day of spring, which officially ends June 21st, so happy spring. Here is the sure-footed Mr. Hart with the local news from the pages of the Ames Tribune.
Thanks very much. It's great to be back here in this seat on this Friday. Let's start where we usually do, with a look back at what made news last Saturday. And what made news was word that a new director had been named for the Ames Public Library. The library board chose Sheila Schofer as the new director. She is now director of neighborhood and public services for the Brooklyn, New York Public Library, and she will start her new job here in Ames on May 31st. Schofer will succeed Lynn Carey, who retired after spending 36 years with the Ames Library, nearly 16 as the director. Schofer was one of two finalists for the position, and she will be paid a $123,000 salary to start. In a statement, she said she was excited to join the library and continue the long tradition of excellence. Saturday also brought word that five Mary Greeley nurses had been honored on the top 100 nurses list in Iowa for this year. They are Candace Flackel, Colette Clearman, Gail Johnson, Angie Carswell, and Joni Williams. They will be honored at a ceremony at the Iowa Events Center in Des Moines on May 5th, which is the start of National Nurses Week. Also Saturday, a feature story about Jan Bauer of Ames, who has just retired as chair of the Story County Democrats. She served in that position for 22 years. She summed up her experience in one word, and that word was fun. She said politics is fun, and if it isn't going to be, people will not get involved. She said her passion for politics was ignited by idealism and by the activist environment of the 1970s, when she was in junior high school. There was more on Saturday, including word that a unique sign company had come to Ames, bringing with it a new look at helping residents celebrate important events in their life. Sign Gypsies has more than 200 locations around the United States. The company provides customizable signs for such things as birthday commemorations or other events. And in sports last Saturday, word that Iowa State University's men's basketball team lost to Ohio State 62-59 in the NCAA basketball tournament. And there was also speculation that ISU head coach Steve Prohm might be on a short list of candidates to become the University of Alabama's next coach, but Prohm downplayed that idea. Sunday brought word about homelessness in Ames and around Iowa. It's estimated that more than 2,700 Iowans were homeless last year. About 700 people come through the Ames-based Emergency Residence Project each year. The Sunday story features a 40-year-old man in Ames who was homeless for nearly a decade and who is now a student at Iowa State University. Also Sunday, a report on Crawford House on Stanton Avenue in Ames. It's a former elementary school that's now being repurposed as a condominium project for those at least 55 years old. When it's finished, It will have 30 units, 24 of them with two bedrooms, the rest with one. Speaking of buildings, there was also word last Sunday that Stevens Auditorium in Ames had been named the most amazing university and college building in Iowa by the USA Today newspaper. The building was named after Clifford Stevens, an Iowa State University alumnus. Sunday also brought word that Julie Weeks is retiring as president and CEO of the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau at the end of May. She's been in those positions since 2000, and before that worked at the Gateway Hotel and Conference Center, then at the Iowa State Center. There was also good news for hamburger lovers last Sunday, confirmation that a Five Guys restaurant will be coming to Ames later this year. It will be on South Duff Avenue across from Walmart, and it's scheduled to open in August. One more note from Sunday, and more good news, at least for fans of Iowa State University's women's basketball team. The Cyclones opened their NCAA tournament play by defeating New Mexico State 97-61. Tuesday brought word that Story County Attorney Jessica Reynolds had made it clear that the sale and distribution of any products containing CBD oil is illegal in the county, and any person or business that takes part in it could be subject to prosecution. CBD is a chemical found in cannabis plants. Iowa code bans it from the state, though it is allowed to be used in some medical cases if it's authorized by a licensed dispensary as approved by the Iowa Department of Public Health. No such licensed dispensaries exist in Story County. Also Tuesday, a story that the Ames School Board had voted in favor of a policy for a student school board representative. The policy will allow an Ames High School student to serve on the board as a non-voting member. The student representative will not attend executive sessions, make motions, or hold board offices. Each student will be selected in the spring for the following academic year and will serve a one-year term starting in August. The school board also approved a transportation contract with Durham School Services until 2022 and set April 8th as the public hearing date for the district's proposed 2019-2020 budget. Tuesday also brought a story about the big field of Democratic presidential candidates, many of whom have already made stops in various town halls and coffee shops in Story County. Political science experts analyzed that big field and the presidential campaign itself. One more note from Tuesday, word that the Iowa State University women's basketball team season came to an end on Monday night. The Cyclones lost in the second round of the NCAA tournament, a game played at Hilton Coliseum. Missouri State defeated Iowa State 69-60. On Wednesday, the big story was that the Story County Board of Supervisors had approved a revised funding request of $2 million and $100,000 in annual operating costs for the Healthy Life Center project. The vote was 2-1 in favor of the funding, with Supervisor Linda Merkin opposed. The board's action comes in the wake of Mary Greeley Hospital's $7 million commitment to the Healthy Life Center and Heartland Senior Services' commitment of $3.5 million. The Ames City Council will take up the matter next at its April 9th meeting. During that meeting, the council will set the amount for a bond referendum that could go before voters as soon as August 6th. Also Wednesday, word that only four members of the public showed up Tuesday night for an informational meeting in Nevada about a newly adopted ordinance amending requirements for home businesses for Story County residents. The new ordinance lets owners of home businesses add two additional employees to have a total of three and lets owners create an outdoor storage area that would be less than 500 square feet and is hidden from any surrounding properties. They would also be able to add a shed for storage that is no larger than 120 square feet. Meanwhile, another community forum that was set to take place in Nevada this past Wednesday night, this about substance abuse, was postponed. The Nevada Substance Abuse Task Force will reschedule the event. Wednesday also brought word that the MHEB company in Story City will undergo a $7 million expansion project this summer. That expansion will result in more than 65 new jobs and increase the company's existing Story City facility by 41,000 square feet. A separate building will also be constructed, and it will have anywhere from 12,000 to 16,000 square feet. The plant will manufacture a new grain trailer at the expanded site, adding to the company's lineup that includes trailers for livestock, horses, and equipment, and a wide variety of aluminum truck bodies. Also Wednesday, a report that the Iowa Beef Center at Iowa State University had hired a new extension program specialist. Beth Reynolds grew up working on a family farm and ranch in her home state of Colorado. She attended the University of Wyoming and the University of Nebraska in Lincoln, where she studied animal science. There was also a report Wednesday about this year's upcoming Lincoln Highway Republican Dinner in Ames. Congressman Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin will be the keynote speaker. The event will take place April 14th at the Gateway Hotel and Conference Center. It's sponsored by the Republican parties of Boone, Story, Greene, and Marshall counties, the ISU College Republicans, and the Republican Women of Central Iowa. One more note from Wednesday, Iowa State University's men's basketball coach, Steve Prohm, and the university agreed to a new contract extension, Prohm will be under contract with the university through the year 2025. Thursday, yesterday, brought word that the City of Ames Public Works Department had begun its annual fire hydrant flushing program. The flushing dislodges sediment and mineral deposits from the city's water mains. Ames has about 3,000 fire hydrants, not including those on the Iowa State University campus. Each hydrant is flushed for about 5 minutes. If residents experience discolored water, they should run cold tap water for a few minutes until it runs clear. Residents are advised to avoid using hot water for washing dishes and clothes when water is discolored. The hydrant flushing program is expected to last 8 or 9 days. Thursday also brought word that the Ames City Council had honored two people at this week's meeting. One of them, retiring Assistant City Manager Bob Kindred, whose final council meeting was Tuesday. Kindred began working for the city back in 1980, spanning 5 mayors and 34 council members. A retirement reception for him will be held this coming Monday, April 1st, from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Community Center Gym on Clark Avenue. Also honored at the council, Ames High School student David Kim, who has dedicated summer months to volunteering. So much so that he's accumulated 250 volunteering hours over the past 4 summers. Also yesterday, a report about tomorrow's, Saturday's, Lions Club Fair that will take place at North Grand Mall. It's an effort by the Ames Breakfast Lions Club to try to inspire the city's youth to have fun while serving their community. It will take place from 1 to 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. And one more note from yesterday, a report that a new business had opened on South Duff Avenue in Ames. It's known as You Break, I Fix, and it's said to be a place that can fix anything that has a power button. The owner claims to have a 60% success rate on fixing things that are broken. And there you have it, your summary of the week's news from the pages of the Ames Tribune. I'm Dennis Hart, hoping I'm not broken, and happy to have been in this seat today. I plan on a return visit on Monday, and I'll bring something with me, a look at what's been making news all around the state of Iowa. In the meantime, here's hoping you have a great weekend.
Thank you, Dennis. This is Local Talk on KHY Community Radio. I am KHY reporter Cece Iverson. The Kerry Chapman Catt Center for Women and Politics in Iowa State University serves to interest, educate, and engage citizens in the political process. They sponsor an annual speaker series to bring a nationally known political leader, scholars, and activists to the Iowa State to educate about the role of women in politics. They sponsor an annual speaker series to bring a nationally known political leader, scholar, and activist to Iowa State. Also, to educate the role of women in politics. Established in 1995, the series honors Mary Lewis Smith, an Iowa native and longtime political and civil leader, the first woman to chair the Republican National Committee. On Monday, April 1st, Florence George Graves, award-winning investigative journalist of the Shorter Institute for Investigative Journalism at Brandeis University, will visit Iowa State University as part of the series. Graves will present hashtag MeToo, Why Has It Taken So Long, at 7:30 p.m. in the Sound Room of the Memorial Union at Iowa State. Karen Kudrowski is the director of the Catt Center. Welcome, Karen. Could you give us a brief introduction to the speaker?
Florence Graves is a former investigative reporter who now heads an investigative reporting think tank at Brandeis University. Part of what they do at Brandeis at the Schuster Center is to train students in investigative reporting techniques by actually have them doing investigative reporting. So if you go to the website, you'll see that there's just a plethora of reports on really important issues, criminal justice reform, immigration and border control issues, as well as gender and politics. Where Ms. Graves made her name as a reporter was with the Washington Post and Common Cause magazine. And 25 years ago, she broke the story about Bob Packwood's sexual harassment behaviors that led to an ethics investigation and eventually his resignation from the Senate. She also unearthed the identity of the other woman who could have, had she testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee, confirmed a number of the allegations that Anita Hill made against Justice Clarence Thomas. Mm-hmm. So that it wouldn't have been literally a he said, she said on that. There would have been some confirmation of those allegations. So she had, and this was, for those of you who remember, the first time that we had a significant national conversation about the nature of sexual harassment in the workplace. And she was part of that growing awareness. And of course, those allegations then led to the Year of the Woman, where we had an unprecedented number of women who ran for the United States Congress and a huge bump up in the percentage of women that served both in the House and the Senate. And that higher level has now been sustained and even built on a bit. And also then the thing that's kind of interesting is that while sexual harassment remained an important subject, I think, within women's advocacy circles, it really did fade from the national conversation until the last two or three years with the reawakening of the Me Too movement, which started with the allegations against Harvey Weinstein. And so what she's going to do is talk about why it took so long from the first time that we had this important conversation until the most recent iteration. And I'm looking very forward to hearing what she has to say.
Yeah. Oh, well, I agree with you. Also, there was, I think there was, I'm pretty sure there was a movement before the Me Too movement called the 3%. And
yes.
And that was kind of like the starter of this gray.
Right. And of course, scholars and other activists have been tracking sexual assault and sexual harassment statistics. We know that from the EEOC, which is the federal agency that enforces civil rights laws, that that is by far the most common sexual discrimination complaint. But I don't think it was similarly at the forefront of our national conversation as it is today. And I think that's really important to draw attention to that. It's an important learning opportunity for both women and men about this form of discrimination and what we can do to stop it and prevent it.
Yeah, and what kind of audience did you expect at this event?
Well, everything that we do at the Cat Center has students at the forefront, of course. And, you know, our students were mostly not even born when Anita Hill had was at the hearings. And so while they've often, especially our women students, have experienced some sort of sex discrimination, but I want to make it clear, not exclusively women, right?
Men also
men
go through this.
Men can, transgendered yes. people who are gay, lesbian, or genderqueer. So I would say that everybody is vulnerable, and one of the things that has come out of our current conversation is that sexual discrimination against men is more prevalent than anyone dreamed, which I hope then adds more urgency to the conversation and helps everyone buy into the urgency. So again, our first audience is, you know, students. But additionally, we seek to engage the entire community. One of the things, I'm relatively new in my position, but one of the things that I find so gratifying about what the Cat Center does is that we really do support the entire state of Iowa. The Cat Center enjoys a reputation across the state of Iowa that I think is very positive because of its good work, particularly promoting women. But to be named for, you know, a key national suffragist, I think to support civic engagement and voter engagement among everyone is certainly within the spirit of how Carrie Chapman Catt lived her life.
Well, that's one of the foundations of this great country, being able to be free and respected and have a decent life, which since the beginning we've been trying, and it's finally we're the richest, most comfortable generation that it has ever existed. Well, thank you so much, Karen, for being here this morning. And we're going to go on. 2020 will be an eventful year for the Cat Center. The 19th Amendment giving women the right to vote will be 100 years old in 2020. And the Cat Center will be leading the citywide centennial celebration. The Cat Center will also be helping engage students around 2020 caucuses and the elections. We have been speaking with Karen Kudrowski, director of the Cat Center. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
No problem.
Karen, before you go, Iowa will be in the national spotlight again in 2020. With the presidential caucuses, how do you intend to gauge students around the election period?
Well, there are a number of people on campus who are interested in hosting a mock caucus, and the Cat Center wants to try and bring those people together and work with students. We also want to make sure that whatever mock caucus we might do includes a mock Democratic and a mock Republican caucus, because we are ardently nonpartisan. But I think it's an important contrast for students to understand that the caucus process for each party is very different. In addition, we want to work with student government and other, you know, portions of the Student Life Administration at Iowa State to educate students about absentee caucusing, which is a brand new element and one that we find very exciting. We also want to bring as many presidential candidates to campus to interact with our students as possible.
And
on April 2nd, Marianne Williamson is coming to campus. So the Cat Center certainly wants to wants to sponsor any appearances by the six women who are in the race, which is pretty darned exciting. And then we are looking at, you know, other things that we can do in terms of a media strategy or blogging or other sorts of general public education. We have the international and national media who will be descending on Iowa, and we want to teach them about the importance of the caucus. But in terms of the Cat Center's perspective, we are at an unprecedented and historic moment where we have several women running, many of whom are extraordinarily viable candidates with strong national presence and fundraising ability. So these are not window dressing candidates or people who are running to make a statement and talk about issues, but people who might actually secure the nomination. And so to look at the gender dynamics of having so many high qualified women in the race is exciting. To look at what this means in terms of gender dynamics between women and men, and how the men have to now confront a whole new set of variables about, you know, implicit and explicit gendered expectations. Some are doing that better than others. And, and so pulling that out is interesting. And then, of course, Mayor Pete Buttigieg is running as the first openly gay candidate, and he is campaigning with his husband. And that, too, adds a whole new gendered element to the presidential race that we have never seen before. Mm-hmm. So it's a very exciting year to be thinking about this in terms of civic engagement, in terms of inclusion, and in terms of gender dynamics. And I'll be happy to come back and talk to you about that more.
Sounds like a great idea. The Cat Center is a great resource as
it's
we
great.
Enter this really unusual and kind Absolutely. Of historic election time.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for coming.
Thank
and
you.
Yes, we'll definitely want you to come back and talk about these new form of caucuses.
Yes.
Keep us abreast of things we'll as they begin to develop.
We will let you know what we're doing.
Iowa.
So, and I, again, want to encourage everyone in the community to join us on Monday night at 7:30 in the Memorial Union for Florence Graves speaking on Me Too, What Took So Long.
Absolutely. We've been speaking with Karen Kudrowski, director of the Cat Center. Thank you. And thank you, Cece.
You're welcome.
For bringing Karen here. Trey Moore is the KHOI intern. He brings you Ames Untold. Just as a point of reference, during this following interview, Trey and the folks he's interviewing are going to be referring to the Divine Nine, which is the Black Greeks at ISU, and they talk a lot about HBCUs. If you have not been familiar with this term, it's an acronym for Historically Black Colleges and Universities. So, Trey, take it away.
K-H-O-I, Ames Community Radio, K-H-O-I. Trey Moore here with another episode of Ames Untold. Today we'll be peering into Black Greek life on Iowa State University's campus. What is it like being a part of a historically Black Greek fraternity or sorority? We're going to get into that today. We have two guests, one from one of the fraternities and one from one of the sororities. Let's get into it. Holding space, community, and tradition. And today we have an AKA here with us, Miss Sydney. I'll let her introduce herself.
Hey, everybody. My name is Sydney Harmon. So I am currently here a graduate student, and I am a member of Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated. I currently serve as a MPHC Divine Nine advisor here on campus. So I'm really excited to speak today.
So Sydney, joining a Black sorority, what was the thought process that led you to making the decision of this was the type of organization you wanted to join, and why specifically Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated?
Yeah, so my pathway into joining a Divine Nine organization actually is somewhat a little bit different than others. So I actually, my family has a lot of background in Greek life. So my mother and my grandmother are a member of my organization, as well as my father being a member of a D9 fraternity as well. So really I was exposed to Black Greek life at a very young age, really, at birth. And to me, that influenced a lot of why I joined Greek life, but also I kind of made my own decision and had my own thoughts too. So for me, it was really seeing the sisterhood that I grew up with, and seeing the connections that the members of Alpha Kappa Alpha had, and just being supportive throughout their entire lives. I grew up seeing that. But another thing for me, it was really the networking opportunities. I think wherever you go, no matter where you move across the country, you're going to be able to find those members of your organization. And this is across all of D9, I would say. You can go anywhere and find people who are going to be willing to support you and help you, whether that's professionally, whether that's in your academics, or whether it's just really getting you connected, to a new environment. So I really, valued that. And then also seeing the role models, a lot of my role models and a lot of the role models of some of my other Black peers were members of D9 organizations, and seeing that they just did a lot of work with youth, and really that's my drive in life is to serve youth and be that role model. So that's some of the reason why I decided to jump into Greek life in general, specifically my organization too, because obviously education, educational advancement is one of the values I think of all D9 organizations, but specifically with AKA, there's an emphasis on more than just education, but when you think about just socially just and global awareness and environmental ownership, so it really encompasses all, and service to mankind is one of our models, and I see that all across all the target areas that we try to reach.
Would you be able to go into the Black sorority experience on ISA's campus?
Yeah, so I actually went to, my undergrad was at Denison University, but obviously being in grad school here, I'm exposed to Greek life, Black Greek life here, and I work specifically with the sororities on campus. And what I see is that really when you go into any leadership organization, any Black organization, you're going to see that most of those leaders are Black women, and a lot of those Black women are members of D9 sororities. So just seeing that leadership, I think, is really prevalent on campus here at Iowa State when you think about D9 organizations. Then also, I see that they're just every member of any D9 sorority is supportive of one another. I think there's this perception that everybody's beefing, or maybe it's AKAs and Deltas don't like each other, or, oh, everybody's fighting for the same members. But no, what I see is that everybody is really, every member of a sorority, AKA, when you think about Deltas, when you think about Zetas, when you think about SG Rose, they're all at each other's programs. They're all promoting each other's programs. And I think that's what I value most about Greek life, D9 life here at Iowa State.
And could you speak on how that this experience would maybe contrast an experience at an HBCU or a more heavily Black populated campus?
Yeah, so one thing that I didn't mention in my previous answer and that relates to this question is that numbers are small. We're in the middle of Iowa. The Black population is scarce in itself. So the chapters range from about 2 members to about 6 or 7. So I think that speaks to any predominantly white institution. You're going to see those lower numbers when you look at D9 organizations. So with that, it helps for that tight-knit, close community, that supportive community within D9 and within D9 sororities specifically. But I think that differs when you go to a HBCU. You'll see that sometimes their chapter sizes are between, 20 to sometimes 100 members. And so that makes it a lot harder to really connect with the different sororities within D9 that you're going to have on campus, and you might be a little bit more limited to supporting other members of your chapter rather than supporting all D9 sororities overall. So that's one of the major differences. But to highlight the positive differences is that at a HBCU, you have a lot more resources to put on programs. You have a lot more resources to reach the entire Black community because it's the whole school is a Black community, so people are a little bit more invested in coming to programs. So it's just at a smaller school, at a predominantly white school, yes, it's a tight-knit community. You're closer, but when you go to HBCU, I think Greek life in general is a little more prevalent in everyday life. So you might go to the dining hall and see people strolling or stepping, but you step into the Memorial Union, you're not necessarily going to see the D9 organization strolling and stepping and doing their calls just because it's not a regular kind of practice. So those are the major differences that I would see when looking at D9 sororities and D9 in general.
Could you list the active sororities on Iowa State's campus?
Yeah, so I mentioned them briefly before, but I'll talk about them a little bit more in depth. So for Alpha Kappa Alpha, Eta Tau is the chapter here. And this is actually a joint chapter between Drake and Iowa State. And then we have the Delta, so Delta Sigma Theta Sorority Incorporated, and that is the Phi chapter. And that's really unique because they're a single letter chapter, which means they're one of the first to be created in the United States, and they're also a joint chapter with Drake and Iowa State. And then we also have Zeta Phi Beta Sorority Incorporated, the Upsilon Nu chapter, and they're just here at Iowa State. They do a lot of programming. They actually have their Zeta Week right now. And then we have Sigma Gamma Rho Sorority Incorporated, and this is Theta Psi chapter, and they are here at Iowa State's campus alone as well. They do a lot for the community. So all 4 of those organizations here, sororities here in D9, they do a lot of work. Even though they're small chapters, they're very strong when it comes to just impact in the community.
Is there something that you would like to make known to someone who doesn't know Black Greek culture or has maybe only seen it in movies and isn't, they don't understand it all the way? Is there something that, a couple things that you wanted to either, stereotypes that you want to shut down or anything that you just want to make known to someone who doesn't know the culture first and foremost?
Yes. Yeah, so, that's a really good question. When I think about myths or stereotypes or, just information that, I think should be known that is not, very well known about D9 organizations and sororities in general is that, they're not just, I think the perception of somebody who might not know a lot about Greek life is that they're not just doing work on campus, but they're going out into the community, they're doing programs for youth, they're going up and picking garbage out of highways, heavily populated highways. So a lot of what they're doing is not just on campus. You'll see them making an impact in the Ames area, in Des Moines, sometimes going out of the state and doing some work to just better the community. So I think it's this perception that they're only on campus doing programs based on community service and just talking about it rather than actually doing that work. So I think that's important to know. But then I talked about this a little bit before too, but the competition piece, you go to yard shows or you go to step shows and you might hear D9 organizations cracking jokes on one another and saying, oh, I'm the best organization and no other organization can top mine. And some of that is some friendly competition, and obviously that's healthy sometimes when you just want to have fun or battle a little bit. But most of the time, that's not all in seriousness. They're not actually having beef with one another. But they're really doing that because just the pride that they have in, well, that we have in our organizations. And that's just a way of showing that. But in all actuality, like I said, that support is there. 'Cause at the end of the day, as a Black community, we're not necessarily trying to put each other down. It's not that competition piece, but we're trying to build each other up no matter what organization you're in, because that was really what MPHC, Divine Nine organizations were founded on, was coming together and providing that space to just uplift other Black individuals in a time where there was a lot of segregation, in a time where they weren't welcomed into other organizations. So no matter the competition or the fake beef that you might see, really the purpose is just to uplift one another, no matter what organization you're a part of.
Thank you. And that was Sydney Harmon from Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated.
What's going on, man? This is Marcus Flynn. I crossed Zeta Kappa Lambda chapter spring 2017. Line name is Spoken Intellect. My line brother is Malik Burden.
And could you go into, what do you mean by line name? When you guys host your crossing ceremonies, why do you have a line name and how does that come about, if you can tell us that information?
So I guess a general description of it is, line name is pretty much given to somebody and it's supposed to kind of characterize like your experience as you're coming through the process, as well as like, I think with mine in particular, it was supposed to be significant of like who you become within the organization as well. And so I think it's somewhat contingent upon who's creating the name and what they want to put into it. But the person who created my name, I think it's a very thoughtful person, and they were thinking about how it could project into the future as well as represent the past.
And so those that bring you into the organization also pretty much help propel you to where you want to go. Just so our audience can get, we have local Ames audience who may not really know the history of these Black Greek fraternities and sororities. So I got some basic questions to shed some light on this, and so they can kind of get a glimpse into this world and this culture that they may not know about. So joining a Black Greek fraternity or sorority, what was the thought process that led you to making this decision that this is something that I want to partake in?
Yeah, I think my process was somewhat similar to most people's. I came to college not knowing much about it. Even though my father's a member of Omega Psi Phi fraternity, I didn't know much about it growing up. I remember he used to wear a lot of purple and gold. Thought it was weird for grown men to wear that much purple. And I was like, man, this man, he must love the Lakers. Mm-hmm. I didn't really understand it. But I got exposed to it once I got to campus. I remember the first thing I saw was a Delta probate, and some of my friends were actually on that line. And from there, I just kind of grew an interest. I saw the probate, then I saw what my friends were doing on campus. And then really my personal interest, especially in Alpha, came from seeing the people who were like in upper levels of administration and seeing that those type of people were attracted to the organization. And from there, I thought, okay, this organization is bringing in these people who are in the positions I kind of see myself in the future, I kind of want to align myself with that organization because there's something about it that's drawn in these common characteristics, and it's something I see in myself, but it's also something I want to develop. And I feel like if you want to develop certain traits, you should be around people who exude those. And so that was kind of how I was drawn, particularly to Alpha, but my interest in Greek life stemmed from kind of just seeing it in action. But I also never had interest in anything outside of Alpha. I couldn't imagine being any other organization, not trying to knock them, but I just never had any interest. Again, my father's a member of Omega Psi Phi. Never thought of it a day in my life. Never considered it. Just couldn't picture it.
And can you tell the audience about all the Black Greek fraternities, how many there are and what are their names?
Yep, so there's Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity Incorporated. There's Kappa Alpha Psi Fraternity Incorporated. There's Omega Psi Phi Fraternity Incorporated. And then there's Iota Phi Theta Fraternity Incorporated. So there's four fraternities in the Divine Nine, which is the nickname for the National Panhellenic Council.
And you were talking about how you're seeing a lot of faculty that were also from the organization. Would you say that Black Greek life is an institution for producing great scholars and just successful students? It's a great institution for that?
Most definitely. I think if you look at, one, this university itself, so our Vice President of Student Affairs, Dr. Martino Harmon, is a member of Alpha Phi Alpha. Our Vice President of Diversity and Inclusion, Dr. Reginald Stewart, is another Alpha. Our Dean of Students, Dr. Vernon Hurt, another Alpha. The Assistant Dean of Students and the Director of Multicultural Student Affairs, soon to be Dr. Kenyatta Schamberger, is another member of Alpha Phi Alpha. So it's a lot of people in these senior level administrative positions are in this fraternity. I don't think that's by mistake. Even Dr. Harmon's predecessor was a member of Kappa Alpha Psi Fraternity Incorporated, Dr. Thomas Hill, who now has an entire conference named after him. The Thomas L. Hill, which is the Iowa State Conference on Race and Ethnicity, is named after him. It's a lot of people who come through these organizations going to do good things because there's a lot of development, and it's also about network. You get to be around people who excel in the positions you kind of see yourself being in, and it really does help to be in those positions, to be around those people, to connect with those people, grow with those people, and do a lot of things.
Could you get into the Black Greek experience on a campus like ISU's? What has your experience been like as an Alpha on Iowa State campus, which is a PWI?
I think there's a lot of opportunity on campus. I think one of the things about Iowa State in particular, just because there's a small number of Black students, the organizations themselves tend to be smaller. So it creates a little bit more of like a burden of having to carry all this work and expectations and do all these things on campus. So there's opportunity to like have events. So there was a Miss Black and Gold pageant about a month ago. There's like different step shows, different opportunity for philanthropic events. So there's still, even though it's a small chapter, there's still the ability to do things on campus and still the opportunity to have impact, even though there's not big numbers.
Do you have peers that are Greeks on HBCU campuses or campuses with a bigger Black population that have told you about their experiences, and you could provide some contrast to what their experiences like on those campuses compared to Iowa State's?
Yeah, most definitely. I think one of the biggest differences is just the size of the Black community. And then I think, too, especially if you're at HBCU, the value system's a little bit different. And so it's a little bit more adulated to be in a Black fraternity on a Black campus because everyone really understands the significance of it. Where at Iowa State, if you talk to somebody who's a Pike or a Sig Eps, a lot of times they're not familiar with what it is. And so you're surrounded by a lot of people who are kind of uninformed. But at HBCU, everyone understands it. And the influence is even greater than it is here just because of more people. Even I named a few administrators, but even more administrators are affiliated. A lot of the students have family. And yeah, it's different. It's like a longer history of tradition. And there's usually a more prominent presence on campus than at a PWI when you constitute such a small number of the student body.
What does Black Greek life mean to you and look like to you?
So I think Black Greek life can look a lot of ways. To me, though, I think one thing that's common among all Black Greeks, like an element of like brotherhood or sisterhood. So really having that bond among people who are in the organization. And then there's also like a service element to it. And so each of the fraternities does some philanthropic event, and they do something So with us, we have our national programs, and I'm pretty sure all the other ones have national programs as well. But they're all about doing service and advocating for a community at the end of the day. And I would say among all Greek Wars, that's the one thing that's that we have in common. We really look out for like that fraternal bond, and then we also look out for the community and doing things out in the for people as well.
What would you like those on the outside of this culture, unaware of this culture, to know about it, and how would you just like it to be painted? Like you said, there's people from some of the bigger non-NPHC fraternities, sororities, who don't really know about it. They don't understand why do you guys do the calls or the steps or, you know, the brotherhood or sisterhood essence of it. I guess, what do you want to tell them about your fraternity, kind of get a basic understanding of it?
Again, in general, one thing that all of the fraternity and sorority members have, or anyone who's in the Divine Nine, it's like really a passion for like community development, and it's really about pushing the needle and making sure that like community level initiatives are met. And it's a lot of work, and people are like really passionate about what they do. People who are in the organizations care a lot about them, because it looks like a lot of fun from the outside when you see people like strolling and doing step shows, but there's a lot of work that goes on behind the scenes, and I think people fail to recognize that sometimes. And I think especially for people who are interested in joining one of the organizations, know that there is work that goes with it. But the work is impactful and it's meaningful. And so I definitely think it's worthwhile. I think people should recognize that Iowa State isn't entirely reflective of the entire Greek community across the country. Different areas, there's much heavier populations. But in general, I think Iowa State does a good job of representing, because everyone I could think of who's either an undergrad or grad school or professional staff, they represent their organization well, and they're really strong organizations in general.
And there you have it. We had Sydney Harmon representing the lovely ladies of Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated, and we had the great Marcus Flynn representing the men of Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Ames Untold, where we get into the untold and untouched topics of the city of Ames. Tune in next time.
Thank you, Trey Moore. Trey is KHOI's intern from the Greenlee School of Journalism, and we are really enjoying him. J.D. Trolton is joining us to tell us a little bit about the rally for the Farmers' Bill of Rights, which is being held up in Storm Lake before the Heartland Forum with a few of the Democratic candidates and a lot of media, I understand. But I can't imagine anyone in our listening area not knowing who J.D. Trolton was. You were the opponent to Steve King. So J.D. is organizing something completely different, and is he here? J.D.?
Yes.
Well, we need you to tell us what's going to be going on up there before the Heartland Forum. Please tell us.
Yeah, so on Saturday at 10:30 at the Storm Lake High School, there is a rally, and it's the Rally for a Farmer's Bill of Rights. Family Farm Action is a group out of Missouri that created this Bill of Rights, and there's speakers and farmers and rural enthusiasts from across the nation. We have dairy farmers coming down from Wisconsin by the busloads. We have folks from Indiana, Ohio, Virginia, the Dakotas, like I said, Missouri here in Iowa, and just all over. And the speakers will be taking one of the aspects of the Bill of Rights, and I'll be talking about market consolidation and how that's affecting Iowa farmers. And Senator Elizabeth Warren will be there, and I believe that she has endorsed the Farmers Bill of Rights. And then Farm Aid is involved with this, and so Willie Nelson will be doing a video that we'll be showing there as well. And so it's just a big gathering of farmers who are frustrated with what's happening and trying to make some change. And we thought it'd be a great opportunity to create a rally before the forum and get some juices flowing.
And what's this with Willie Nelson and Farm Aid?
Yeah, so, I mean, they're one of the sponsors of the rally. And so my Working Hero Iowa, my nonprofit, we're an anti-poverty nonprofit, and so we decided to be a co-sponsor as well. And so it's been a great opportunity for a lot of different groups who talk of similar things coming together and talking about and raising awareness of a lot of the frustration that's happening in modern agriculture.
You have made a video that you're going to be showing. I was very interested in this because our last program dealt with the renewable fuels issue.
Yeah.
And I understand you're highlighting the abuse of the renewable fuel standard. Would you like to talk a little about that video and that movement?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So what we've seen, we know how important ethanol is here in Iowa, and what we've seen with this Trump administration is the abuse of the small refinery waiver. And so these waivers are an opportunity for smaller refineries who might face economic hardship with the mandate of the renewable fuel standard, the RFS. But what the Trump administration has done has given anyone who's asked for the, or at least over 50 of these economic hardship waivers out, and they gave one in December to ExxonMobil. So a $20 billion oil company is given these small refinery waivers, and that's not right. And so as a result, how does that hurt Iowans? Well, it's left nearly a billion bushels of corn in the bin, and that's driving down our corn prices by up to 40 cents a bushel. And so you just see throughout Iowa the ripple effect of when you have these low corn prices, then the farmer doesn't spend as much, maybe doesn't buy that new truck, and it's this ripple effect in rural Iowa. And that's where we're seeing a lot of hardship economically in Iowans, not these big oil companies. And so the Trump administration has really put it, their thumb on the scale towards the oil conglomerates, and has really hurt Iowa farmers and the Iowa economy.
I think outside of the farm community, that is something that isn't understood at all.
Yeah, and that's why I made that video, to try to simplify it as much as possible, because it does get a little wonky, but it's so important to what we're trying to do here in Iowa and what already exists. And, I mean, farmers are struggling, whether it's market consolidation and the amount of monopolies that are affecting the day-to-day lives of farmers, and low prices of and the cost of production, and then the renewable fuel standard, and then the third part of it are the tariffs. And the easiest way I can sum that up is we're borrowing money from China to give to our farmers to not sell their products to China, and we're just, our backs are against the wall, and that's what all these farmers are coming to do on Saturday, coming to the rally, because they're frustrated.
You're meeting in a gym. What happens if you actually have an overflow crowd?
Well, I mean, I think we have the option to go out to the parking lot there. And I don't know if you remember, but my RV for the campaign, Sioux City Sioux, I'm busting it out of retirement for one day only for this event. And I tried to let folks know that if you're a farmer between Sioux City and Storm Lake, and so you're, if you're on the way and you want a ride, I'd be more than happy to pick you up.
Well, that'll be something. Thank you, and have a great day tomorrow.
Thank you very much. I'm really looking forward to this weekend.
That was J.D. Scholten, Director of Working Hero America. You've been listening to Local Talk on KTY Community Radio. You have a gang of hosts for today. We have been Ursula Rudenberg, C.C. Iverson, Trey Moore, and myself, Susan Franzen. Al-Kathari has been our engineer. Thank you for listening.
Local Talk airs 7 a.m., noon, and 5 p.m. on Fridays. Also remember that you can hear a recording of today's show online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI streaming live at khoifm.org. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD The Ballad of Kay Chelly, and earlier we heard The Rite of Spring. No, we heard Appalachian Spring by Aaron Copeland.
Stay tuned for headline news and Democracy Now! At 8 a.m., followed by morning masterpieces. Remember, you, the listener, are the one who makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening. I will see you
again on the radio.
Again on the radio.
Funding for KHOI is provided in part by the Iowa State Center, presenting the San Francisco Symphony, March 29th, 7:30 p.m. More information can be found at center.iastate.edu.